This is The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. The title race, top four and relegation were the focal point on the pitch, with implications across the Premier League table. But it was the question of ownership that took centre stage in a week Chelsea and Newcastle walked out of the tunnel together, with football far from the focus. Liverpool closed the gap on Manchester City again. Ronaldo's posturing puts Manchester United in pole position to challenge Arsenal for the Champions League places. Surely Tottenham just want another chance in the Europa League conference, don't they? Another defeat to a relegation rival for Norwich, a Burnley finally down, and VAR had another busy weekend. All this plus your questions, and that is today's Guardian Football Weekly. Okay, panel, I'm going to do a fake drum roll. Uncle Barry has some news.
Well, Faye, I think the listeners will have guessed by dint to the fact that you're presenting that there have been activities in Australia, and I hope we're not stealing anyone's thunder, but because I think we have been given permission to announce the arrival of Ian Rushton into the world. We have seen a photo. We're obliged to say he's beautiful, even though he isn't yet. And Mother Jamie is tired, but well, everyone's healthy and happy, and it's great news.
It's wonderful news. Well done, the current Mrs. Rushton, and well done, Max, as well. And well done, Godfather Barry. I mean, I think we're all rooting for you there, Baz. Jim wanted to know, given your upbringing, shouldn't you have been at the birth assisting?
Well, I could have assisted, and I no doubt I'd have done a decent job if called upon, but I think the right people were in charge.
I second that, and I believe Jonathan Wilson might third it.
Yeah, I feel a bit like a shepherd turning up the stable on December the 26th.
not one of the three kings, not bestowing any gifts.
But they're quite late, aren't they? They don't turn up until January the 6th. So whoever does
I wouldn't have known that.
A week on Thursday, they're probably in the role of the Magi.
Robin Cowan, you've obviously been through this, as have I. It's a momentous moment for all.
Whoever says it's the best day of your life is lying. It's the most stressful day. But wonderful,
so
everyone's well. That's the most important thing.
Absolutely. It really, really is. Congratulations to both of you. I'm sure there will be plenty of suggestions of names coming Max's way when he returns to Twitter. I'm sure he won't be off it for very long. Right, we've got a pod to do. And unfortunately, it's not a pod that many of us enjoy doing in terms of the top game that we're going to discuss, because it's Chelsea 1, Newcastle 0 on the pitch. Let's talk about the football first and foremost, even though it's the least important part, of course. Kai Havertz with the only goal of the game. Took it brilliantly as well, Barry. His form's been so good recently.
Yeah, it was a splendid goal to crown a very weird occasion and not a particularly good game. And I suppose it's kind of understandable that it wasn't a particularly good game, and discussing the play is very much in any way Mrs. Lincoln, what did you think of the play territory. But a wonderful ball over the top by Jorginho. Kai Havertz's takedown was absolutely sublime, and his finish in a tight pocket of space was a thing of great beauty. Whether or not he should have been on the pitch is another matter, of course, which I suppose we'll get to in time. But I think Chelsea got away with one there. They were quite lucky. There was some very poor refereeing, but it was a real moment of quality in, as I say, what was not really a very good game of football.
Yeah, we'll get to the refereeing shortly. But yeah, Kai Havertz has scored in three consecutive Premier League appearances for the first time. He's had a hand in six goals in all competitions in his last five games as well. Bearing in mind his form, Jonathan, can you see a way back for Lukaku?
Not in big games, I wouldn't say. No, not at the moment. Which seems such a bizarre thing. You know, tail end of last season, we sort of thought, oh, yeah, well, all he needs is a proper centre-forward, and suddenly they're the complete package. But for whatever reason, he hasn't fit into that system. And yeah, I think they look better with that greater mobility up front, which, again, some of us don't understand. So you think of Lukaku, and the sort of performance that sort of, for me, stands out was him for Belgium against Brazil in the World Cup quarterfinal in 2018. When he basically, well, he did. He played as a right winger with Kevin De Bruyne as a false nine. And so having seen him play like that day and seen him on other occasions playing for Belgium, pulling out to the right, letting De Bruyne go through the middle, I sort of assumed he'd be able to do that for Chelsea. And then they could have him as the number nine, working all the way across the front line, creating space for two behind, you know, Mount and one other, Havertz perhaps, or Ziyech or Pulisic. It just hasn't worked. And they do look better when they have Havertz. And you know, he's creating the space for others. And you know, he's very good in front of the goal himself.
I mentioned the refereeing. Newcastle, Robin, thought they should have had a penalty. I think everybody in the stadium thought they should have had a penalty. Every Chelsea fan, every football fan thought they should have had a penalty. Jacob Murphy brought down by Trevor Chalobah. Bit embarrassing.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a penalty. You know, had hold of his shirt for a very long time, and not only that, sort of the top of it. So really, it was so, it looked very, very obvious. The only thing I'd say is that we do see that a lot, and we do see penalties not given a lot in those situations. So it's just another thing, another example of if referees start giving those consistently, then probably it will stop happening. But it's just
So give them.
Exactly.
It's just ridiculous.
No, exactly. It's just another example of that. And yeah, no, I feel like they have every right to feel hard done by in that situation. In terms of the elbow from Havertz on Dan Burn, I'm just really impressed. Dan Burn's 6'7". He managed to get his elbow up into his face. I mean, when they were both jumping. And yeah, again, I think he was slightly lucky in that situation.
Yeah, as I say, it wasn't really a game for the football, that's for sure. Let's focus on things outside of what happened on the pitch, away from the game. Obviously, the Saudi Interior Ministry confirmed 81 individuals had been executed, with offences ranging from joining militant groups to holding deviant beliefs. A statement read, these individuals, totalling 81, were convicted of various crimes, including murdering innocent men, women and children. Crimes committed by these individuals also include pledging allegiance to foreign terrorist organisations such as ISIS, Al-Qaeda and the Houthis. Newcastle supporters unfurled a Saudi flag at Stamford Bridge. Newcastle manager Eddie Howe asked for his thoughts on the 81 deaths in his post-match press conference and said this: I'm just going to stick to football. I'm still bitterly disappointed about the result. My job is to coach the football team and to get results for the football team. When he was pushed on it a bit further, he said, I'm aware of what's happening in the world. I've made my position clear. Who wants to take this first and foremost? Is it good enough from Eddie Howe, Barry?
I don't think so. It's quite something when you're not prepared to come out and say that you think the execution of 81 people is not a great thing. It's not good. A lot of Newcastle fans get very upset when Eddie Howe is asked questions about the club's owners. And I can kind of see their point. They would argue that he's a football coach and that these questions should be directed to people like Amanda Staveley. But the problem is that Amanda Staveley never faces the press. She gives interviews to one favourite journalist who doesn't press her on these issues. That's entirely his prerogative. So Eddie Howe is the public face of the club, and I don't think it's too much to ask. If he has an opinion on his club's owners, he's well within his rights not to offer one. But you can see Thomas Tuchel is quite happy to, generally quite happy to field these questions, answer them, these kind of questions, and answer them to the best of his ability. Eddie Howe knew what he was taking on when he accepted the job and presumably knew these questions would be coming. He's opted to shut them down, but I don't think it makes him look very good. And I find it quite disappointing, to be honest.
Yeah, Robin, you do a lot of post-match interviews with managers. I mean, he should expect these kind of questions, shouldn't he? He should have a better response. But as Barry says, perhaps Newcastle need to be putting somebody else up.
Yeah, and I think that's why you have a little bit of sympathy with him and with Thomas Tuchel, because they are left fielding these sorts of questions, but quite rightly so. And I just agree with Barry. I feel like every time he says, I'm sticking to football, his reputation just takes another hit. It's really, really not a good look. Thomas Tuchel, you know, obviously while still not really wanting to upset, I suppose, that his employers is much more erudite and, you know, willing to answer, at least answer these questions and not just give that sort of stock answer. So I think Eddie Howe, he could do better in these situations. And I just have huge admiration for these journalists who do ask them, because I'm not a fan of doing these interviews. That's probably the part I enjoy least of my job. So really, really good work from the journalists who are willing to continue to press managers on these issues.
Let's hear from what Thomas Tuchel had to say after the game when he was questioned whether or not he was going to stay as manager of Chelsea. There's no doubt I stay until the end of the season. We just have to wait day by day because everything can change. The club's for sale, but hopefully it goes through. So day by day, which is a good way to live your life anyway. There are circumstances we can't influence, but that gives us the freedom to focus on the things we can influence. The focus is on the first team, our players and me. But Chelsea is much more than just the first team. It's a massive club with huge tradition, hundreds of staff. It's not just the players, and it's important we show the spirit and give them the distraction. Of course, they play Lille in the Champions League this week, Jonathan. Thomas Tuchel, I mean, if there's allowed to be a moment of humour in this, I suppose he's, you know, taking it the right way as a deflection, but saying that they do have a plane to fly there at the moment, but they'll be there regardless, even if he has to drive a 7-seater minibus.
Yeah, I mean, Tuchel throughout this has just sort of come across as a human. In an ideal world, he probably wouldn't have been working for Roman Abramovich, but modern football, yeah, the nature of it is, if you want to compete at the highest level, it's very hard to find an owner who's not in some way objectionable. Now, obviously, there's tiers within that. But yeah, I did a piece for The Observer on Sunday saying, like, clearly states, oligarchs are bad for football. And we've been clear about that for however many years. But also hedge funds, who are only there to take a profit, are not great for your football club. It might work in the short term, but eventually they're going to want a profit. And that doesn't necessarily mean you're getting the best for your football team. So if you actually, you know, if you look at the 20 Premier League clubs, if you take out states, oligarchs, public investment funds for states, just to be absolutely clear that it's not Saudi Arabia who owns Newcastle, but the public investment fund of Saudi Arabia. You take out hedge funds, you take out absentee foreign owners with no real connection to the club, you take out tax exiles, as you have with Tottenham. You're left essentially with two professional gamblers and a TV chef. Now, one of those professional gamblers was named in the Panama Papers. So, you know, you can ask questions about that as well. So basically, the one we're left with is Delia, and we're a Norwich at the bottom of the table. So there is no such thing as a good owner in modern football. And so I understand why top players, top managers have to compromise principles, you know, just in order to work at the highest level. I think what you can do in that circumstance is at least be like Tuchel and admit these are problems and talk about, you understand your place in the world and you understand it's not great, and at least deal with it with a level of humanity rather than this, the Eddie Howe, I just want to talk about football, which if, yeah, and it, you know, again, this is just repeating what we said, but if Newcastle regularly put up somebody else to talk about things that weren't just the football team, that would be fine, but they don't. And therefore, he is a public face of the club and he has to take those questions. Tuchel, I think, has handled the situation, slightly different situation, but not dissimilar situation. It's handled it far, far better with far greater dignity and far greater humanity.
Are you saying that the solution is that we have a Premier League and that's all exclusively owned by television chefs?
Yes, I would. Yeah, I mean, we know about Gordon Ramsay's involvement in football.
I think Ainsley Harriott would be amazing. Come on, Baz. Jinx. Oh, dear. Who would Ainsley be in charge of, Baz?
Well, he's an Arsenal fan, I think, so I presume he could take over from Stan Kroenke.
Love it. Love it.
In fact, they could maybe do it like Ready, Steady, Cook, where two members of the public turn up with 11 players they've bought in the previous week and say, go on, put a team together from that.
And everybody can vote based on, at the end of the game, whether they thought it was a good performance or not with their red, what was it, red tomatoes and green? What was the...
Red and green peppers, I think.
Peppers, that's it. Peppers, thank you. Right, this is the latest situation in terms of what's going on at Chelsea. Hyundai are the latest company to suspend its association with the club. The Korean car maker signing a 5-year sleeve sponsorship deal back in 2018, but said, in the current circumstances, we've suspended our marketing and communication activities with the club until further notice. Main sponsors, Three, of course, suspended its links with the club on Thursday. Chelsea's credit card facilities have been temporarily suspended while banks assess the implications of sanctions imposed on Roman Abramovich. But the club has been given a special license to operate. Who knows what the current state of play is with regards to the Chelsea sale?
Well, yeah, my understanding of it is that Abramovich has to green light it until such a point as Chelsea slip to administration, which will happen later this year if things don't change. But I think, you know, the license is continually being renegotiated, essentially because what, you know, the initial statement from the government was very blunt, and as they obviously and to be fair, understandably so, that they can't sort of phase in the sanctions over a period. It has to be now you are sanctioned, and they then work out the details later. And why would anybody who works at the Treasury, why would they know exactly what is involved in running a football club? So that is still being discussed. I think we've already seen the budgets for security and for travel have been increased because, you know, they haven't quite realised how much that costs. I mean, I've heard, so for instance, with Barclays suspending the credit cards, because liability lies with the banks, I know banks are uneasy even about players' accounts and have to be very clear what is going into the player accounts. It is just salary and travel expenses. So things like win bonuses, I think, are sort of still a grey area. Now, I can't pretend that's an area I really understand. I guess the point is that is still being worked out exactly what that means. And clearly that all then has implications for the sale because that impacts on exactly what revenues the club is able to take in and therefore at what point it reaches a point of non-sustainability without having to bring in administrators.
Yeah, and that's really interesting, actually, because the government says it's confident that the sale of Chelsea will move quickly, but there's so many moving parts to it that surely it's going to slow things down for sure.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that I think where it could happen quickly is if the price plummets, then if you're a potential buyer and if Abramovich is happy to sell or is willing to sell, maybe rather than happy, then maybe you do pounce and think, you know what, even if I could get this cheaper in 6 months, I can get it now for, I don't know, 800 million or something, and this is an asset worth 2.5 billion. Maybe that does speed it up if people think, actually, this is a real bargain. But to be honest, I just don't know about that. And the thing that, you know, again, as somebody who has only a basic grasp of finance and business, I would look at an asset that has needed £1.5 billion put in over the last 19 years. Admittedly, the gap has been narrowing, but it's losing money every year without that investment. Clearly you can't run it like that unless you're prepared to put that money in which case it's not making a profit by definition. So what can you trim? And when you do trim costs, to what extent does that have an impact on success on the pitch and the viability of it as an asset? And that's where, I mean, this is such a tangential point, but it becomes quite significant. The fact that Chelsea have had such problems trying to upgrade the stadium, there is no property near that you can buy. They tried to buy Battersea Power Station, that didn't quite work out. They had those great plans for developing the present site, but they're incredibly complex because of the graveyard on one side and the railway line on the other. So those plans involve building over the railway line, which clearly puts a huge additional cost. They'd have the issue of where do they play if they're redeveloping the stadium. And that's a stadium that's only got a capacity of, 42,000, something like that, which in modern terms for Super Club is tiny. And also, they don't have the same corporate facilities that an Arsenal has or a Tottenham has. And how can you get those without massive redevelopment? So I think the stadium becomes a real sticking point if you're looking at it purely as a business asset.
Yeah, yesterday it was just a really toxic occasion, and Jacob Steinberg wrote a very coruscating, impassioned and excellent piece, which I would urge listeners to seek out, just about what a horrible occasion it was. Because you've got a club whose owners face sanctions, playing against a club whose tyrannical owners shouldn't have been allowed by the club in the first place, but they were because of the Premier League don't have a fit and proper persons test. You know, Saudi Arabia should probably be facing sanctions too, but they won't because they have a cozy relationship with the British government. And it's just very distasteful. And then this simmers over onto Twitter, where you've got journalists being attacked, politicians being attacked by fans of various clubs. There's horrible whataboutery. And it's just really unpleasant. And I wish we didn't have to talk about it, but it's something that has to be addressed.
The problem with the fit and proper persons test, though, and this is where I have a little bit of sympathy with the FA and with the Premier League, is that if you stop somebody buying a business and they take legal action against you, what do you do? It has to be above that. It has to be written in law. But then I don't know. I mean, I guess now British law, you can put that check in. I mean, before Brexit, presumably you'd have been subject to EU law and then wouldn't have been able to stop people buying the club. So the fit and proper person test, as it stands, is you can't be a director with an outstanding criminal conviction or with sanctions. So that's why this has happened post-sanctions. It's very hard to take action against people before you have those concrete bits of evidence.
Yeah, I think these questions are going to continue to be asked, as they rightly should be. The Rain Group, by the way, which is the investment bank overseeing the process of the Chelsea sale, has given potential bidders until 18th of March to submit their proposals. The government views that one bid with Nick Candy and a consortium as serious contenders. It's also emerged, the third person involved with that, by the way, is Jonathan Goldstein, who's the CEO of Kane International. Sources in Westminster, though, haven't ruled out the chances of a takeover bid from Saudi media succeeding. The company's led by Mohammed Al-Kareji, who's also the CEO of its parent company, Engineer Group Holding. Meanwhile, Sir Martin Broughton, who helped facilitate Fenway Sports Group's takeover of Liverpool back in 2010, is reportedly considering whether or not he will enter the bidding. That's it for part one. In part two, we'll look at the rest of the Premier League's action. Welcome back to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Listen, we're running a podcast survey and we'd love as many of you as possible to take part. All you need to do is go to www.guardiansurveys.com/podcast. Be kind, please, be kind. Right, Manchester United 3, Spurs 2. What a game this was in the end. Jonathan, Ronaldo hat-trick, where are we with him?
Well, I don't think anything's changed. I mean, we know he's a brilliant centre forward. We know that he's capable of scoring brilliant goals. I think we've maybe started to question that over the past couple of months when his form's dipped. But he still creates massive tactical issues for them. I don't think it was a particularly good United performance. I actually thought it was a very strange game. It was very engaging, very good to watch. But there was sort of a 25-minute spell in the second half where quality was awful. Neither side could string two passes together. You know, yet again, it's Ronaldo getting United out of jail. It's a great hat-trick. It's almost like the three goals represent the three phases of his career. The long-range strike was a bit like his goal away to Porto in 2009. The sort of Predators finish, which is sort of, is the Real Madrid period, Ronaldo. And then that sort of big header from a corner, which is, sort of recent Ronaldo when he sort of turned himself into an early 1950s British centre-forward. He was brilliant and deserves all the plaudits, but I still think United would be better without him. Maybe not on Saturday because they had so many players out to injury. But
well, they wouldn't have won the game without him on Saturday.
Well, you say
Tottenham
that.
Tottenham were the better team, bar Ronaldo, I would say.
Yeah, why were Tottenham able to get back in the game though? Why were they, every time they went behind, why were they able to then take control of possession? It's because United don't have a structure to get the ball back off them, and they now are sort of forced to invite teams back onto them, but they don't have the sort of pace in forward areas, which used to be what made them, the good games under Solskjaer were when they sat deep and attacked, counter with great pace. Well, they can't counter with great pace now. So their only real way of playing at the moment is defend deep, cling on, hope Harry Maguire doesn't do anything too daft, and then hope that Ronaldo does something brilliant in the other box. Well, that's not really a way of playing football.
No, I would agree with that. We'll get to Harry Maguire in a minute. I mean, Robin, do you think Eric Dier perhaps shouldn't have been standing off Ronaldo as far as he was for that first goal.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think all of them were defensively not great from Spurs. And also the second one was like a millimetre the other way and it would have been offside. So, yeah, I mean, I've read enough Jonathan Wilson pieces to know that they're less functional, but he's just clinical, isn't he? Because that's been United's problem. You feel like they, especially in sort of first halves of games, they've battered teams and they haven't scored. And then they are usually, as unfortunately, as Jonathan said, you know, our brave England centre-half, Harry Maguire, oh, how many times have we seen him look mournfully after a mistake this season? It's just, it's very painful.
So to be fair to him, I don't want to sort of, this is not sort of a, you know, pointing at Harry Maguire and laughing and saying, ah, what a joke, what a terrible football he is. He's been horrendously exposed by the structures around him. You know, the back of United midfield has been dreadful for a long time. His confidence is clearly gone. He's not the most graceful figure, which makes it look worse. And he's now started to make really bad mistakes. So I was talking to Paul Parker yesterday about the own goal, and he was saying the body position is, you know, you basically your first week when you get trained professionally is don't put your body in that position. And you know he obviously he knows that's not what he's meant to be doing, but just everything has fallen away from him, and he needs a reset. I don't think he's a terrible player at all. I just think he's having a terrible time.
Of course he's not.
He's
an England international, and maybe if he's selected by Gareth Southgate, which of course many people think that if Southgate's going to stick with what he says and pick players on form, that Harry Maguire shouldn't be selected. But if he is selected, because, you know, he's part of the leadership team for England, then, you know, maybe this is the reset he needs, a bit of a break away for 2 or 3 weeks to come back afresh, if you like.
Interesting. Just before he scored that own goal, Ralph Raniak was trying to bring on Victor Lindelof to sort of help shore up the defence. But the ball wouldn't go out of play. He couldn't get him on. And then Reguilon sent in the cross, which Harry hacked into his own net. And if he hadn't touched the ball, Christian Romero would have tapped in, but he was offside. So bad positioning from Harry Maguire, but yeah, he just can't buy a break at the moment. If he had ducks, they'd drown.
But also, if he'd have not gone for the ball, everybody would have been on his back for not going for the ball, you know, if Romero hadn't been offside. So I feel as if he can't win at the moment.
But this is another example. I mean, you know, we talk about this within the Leeds-Norwich game as well, where the modern offside law, that bit of it makes no sense, because defenders have to go for balls, but if there's a player offside behind them making them go for the ball, that should still be offside. So Maguire, you know, whatever about his body position, he's sort of been done by that in the same way that Norwich were done with that, with Bamford being offside.
Yeah, I agree, and we will get to that shortly. I want to wrap this one up, though. We'll talk about Spurs, actually, in a second. But Barry, Tim wants to know, how many of those three Ronaldo goals do you think you could have put away?
I don't think I'd have scored any of them, Faye.
Oh, the second one, Barry, you would have shown composure to put that away, surely.
No, I wouldn't have had the pace to be up to get on the end of the cross, Robin, I'm afraid. And yeah, that was described as a tap-in. I was saying to Max yesterday that I think if you have to work to beat the keeper, it's not a tap-in. I don't think he got the credit he deserved for that goal, even though it was the most straightforward of the three.
Well, I love your honesty, Baz. That's brilliant. Robin, just finally, Tottenham's last seven results. Now, I always argue this, by the way. It's all about semantics, but lost one, lost one, lost one, lost. Why so inconsistent? Although I actually think that that's consistency.
Yes, good point. It's very consistent.
Have they improved at all under Conte?
Well, they seem happier. They really seem very miserable under Nuno. But yeah, they just, again, they have these sort of lapses, which must drive Conte absolutely crazy. And I think almost he could strike fear into them. And it doesn't seem to be working on a consistent basis. Although I think someone pointed out that when they've had a bit of a break and more time with Conte, they've performed better. They've had quite a few postponements, I think, and I think he only trusts a few players. So I think maybe when they have the sort of fixture congestion, they're not so good.
Well, they need to get used to that. we've got a Winter World Cup coming up, so you know they're going to have to get used to it, I'm afraid. Right, Brighton 0, Liverpool 2. Liverpool closing the gap on Manchester City to 3 points yet again. The ball from Matip for the Diaz goal was absolutely brilliant, Baz. Diaz finished it so well, but here we go, VAR discussion yet again. How lucky was Sanchez to escape punishment for that high challenge?
I think he was incredibly fortunate. It's been likened to the Tony Schumacher challenge on Battiston in the game, famous game between Germany and France. Was it 86?
82.
Which is one of my earliest football memories, actually, that horror challenge that went unpunished. It was very brave of Diaz to go for that ball. Other players might have bottled it. He is hugely impressive. I've been so impressed with him since he came to Liverpool, the manner in which he's just slotted in seamlessly. I think there's no doubt Sanchez should have been sent off.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Jonathan, Charlie sends in a question. Did the fact Diaz scored influence the decision to not send off or at least book Sanchez, and should it?
It probably did, and no, it shouldn't, because what that question comes down to, are you sending him off for denial of a goal-scoring opportunity? Well, clearly, if he scored, you haven't denied it. But it's serious foul play. I mean, he smacked him in the head. And I don't understand why keepers... I mean, it happens all the time. Keepers get away with that. You think of Manuel Neuer on Gonzalo Higuain in the 2014 World Cup final. That keepers somehow are allowed to commit fouls that other players would be sent off for... Yeah, without a second thought from anybody. So the fact the ball went in is irrelevant. He smashed him in the head. It's just a clear red card. And the VAR excuse, we couldn't see clear contact. I mean, in which case there has never been a penalty in the entire. Yeah, there's never been a penalty in the entire history of football. Like,
are they watching the wrong screen?
They must be watching boxing and going, why are they not hitting each other? Like, it's like...
Yeah. They've all got bubble wrap around their heads. It's the fifth successive defeat for Brighton, Robin. They've scored just once in six games. Is this a case for Graham Potter's side of, right, we've done all our business early on, feet up and just watch how the rest of the season plays out for everyone else?
Oh, it's a real shame if that is the case, because I really do think they have a lot of quality and the way they play is really good. But it's so dull talking about them, because it's just the same thing. They create loads of chances and they just don't take them. You know, Trossard started the season really well and his sort of, I don't know, his aim's slightly off now. It's just, need someone more clinical, or to go on, they don't have a striker who'll give you a guaranteed sort of double figures every season. So yeah, that's the issue. But it's been a pretty dreadful run, as you've outlined there, for Brighton. But I think that's probably, they probably started the season a little bit better than you'd expect, and they're probably now where sort of levelling out where they should be.
Mm. Speculation, by the way, Barry, that Mo Salah's stalling over his contract. We've talked about this for a while now, really. Jurgen Klopp, when asked, said Mo definitely expects this club to be ambitious, and we are. It's Mo's decision. The club did what it can do. That's how it is. Can you ever envisage a situation where Mo Salah leaves Liverpool?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think the owners will appreciate him holding them to ransom. And I think they have to break the wage structure to keep him. And I think the arrival and huge success since his arrival of Luis Diaz now gives Liverpool some wriggle room. They don't need him as much as maybe they did a couple of months ago. So, I could see him leaving, definitely.
The fact nobody's come in for Salah yet, I think, is indicative of the fact that everybody's sort of thinking, how much do we really want to spend for somebody who's going to turn 31 next season?
Newcastle might buy him.
Well, yeah.
I'm not joking. It would be the kind of marquee signing I think they would possibly go for, and I think they'd pay him whatever he wants.
Yeah, statement of intent, that's for sure. Arsenal were making their top four statement of intent. 2-0 win over Leicester at the Emirates. Thomas Partey on the score sheet. Alexander Lacazette with a penalty as well. Sean wants to know, Barry, after their fifth win in a row and ninth in 11 games, do you stand by your statement from last week's pod that Arsenal are unconvincing and inconsistent?
My position is weakening by... with each result that they register. I was very impressed with them yesterday, and it's a very young team, a very hugely impressive youngsters. They will have to do more to convince me that they are not flaky Arsenal. We'll see how they get on when they're facing other big six teams, I suppose. But Martin Odegaard yesterday, wonderful performance. What a signing he's been for them and will continue to be. I definitely was laughing at Mikel Arteta at the start of the season and making fun of his talk about sticking with the process. And he has made me look slightly foolish.
Oh, well, thanks for admitting it. I'm sure Mikel will be really pleased
he'll be delighted
to say that to you.
You're
as
on
well.
The dressing room wall, Barry.
Yep.
Well, I wasn't alone in making fun of him, I hasten to add, but I'm prepared to concede that he might actually know what he's doing.
But the thing I'd still say, you know, these five wins in a row, it's Wolves twice, Watford, Leicester and Brentford. Well, Arsenal should win those games. Maybe not Wolves.
Yeah, but last season, they'd have made that tricky for themselves.
Well, yeah, but that's a sort of... I mean, you're right, they would have done. But that still doesn't mean you're going to be top four. Being able to beat sort of mid-table-ish, lower mid-table, lower table sides is what they should be doing. We just had one of them in a row. And it was the same earlier in the season. I think, oddly, the most impressive... But, you know, the thing from... If I were an Arsenal fan, the thing from which I draw most encouragement is how well they played in losing to Manchester City. And that suggests they can actually play against top six sides. And yeah, they've got Liverpool on Wednesday.
Yeah, Wednesday. And that's going to be really interesting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So what they're very good at the moment is winning 2-0 against weaker teams. Can they do it against teams who are their peers or slightly better? And Wednesday will be a big clue to that.
And arguably Leicester aren't a weakened team, although obviously this season they've not shown their best and been hampered by lots of injuries. But you know, that's a game that would have been at the beginning of the season written down. Perhaps you'd easily say it was a Leicester win. And things change, don't they, in the Premier League.
On Leicester, I don't know if Jonathan, I wanted to ask actually, because they conceded their 20th goal from a set piece in the Premier League. And Brendan Rodgers afterwards said there wasn't enough commitment to keep the ball out of the goal, which suggests to me that he was quite happy with the way they were set up. I mean, Jonathan, this is not something I notice, really. I just look at where the ball goes and everything. But has he tried different ways of trying to defend corners? Or
he did. Which game was it? It was the Liverpool game they played. League Cup game, or was it the league game? They switched from a zonal system to a more man-to-man system. It was around about Christmas time. One of those Liverpool games where they made the change. But it has made no difference at all. But they weren't very good last season. They let in, I think, 11 last season from corners. So I mean, obviously 20 is worse. But 11 is still really bad. I think they were still the worst, or maybe the second worst last season. So that's an ongoing problem. I mean, clearly this season they've been hampered by all the centre-backs being broken all the time. There's a fundamental thing when corners are coming in the box. You want your big, strong line at the back attacking the ball. That's still a basic of defending, whether you're doing it man-to-man or zonal. And when you lose them, obviously you lose a bit of structure and you lose that bit of height and aggression. So, it's a major issue for him, because the two things where you see a manager losing it or not quite being up to it is if they can't defend against counter-attacks and if they can't defend against set plays, because those both seem like pretty basic, sorted out on the training ground. If it's not going right, you're doing something wrong. I cut him some slack until he gets two or three centre-backs back, but it's not good.
Right, let's wrap up part two of the pod with West Ham 2, Aston Villa 1. Andrei Yarmolenko emotional when he scored, as you would expect, his first game since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. He got a great reception from both sets of fans when he came on in the second half, spoke to Sky Sports afterwards and said, "I tried to give everything on the pitch. It was so emotional for me because of the situation in my country. It's so difficult for me right now in this moment thinking about football because every day the Russian army is killing Ukrainian people. I just want to say thank you to my teammates who support me all the time, every day. To West Ham fans, they also support me, and Ukrainian people, and also the British people, because we feel you support us." Jonathan, you were there at the London Stadium. Really emotional scenes.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, I think Yarmolenko hasn't really worked at West Ham for him. I mean, I remember seeing him, it was just after he arrived, I think he was away at Everton. He was brilliant. You sort of thought, you know, because he's quite an odd player in terms of he's really big but also really skillful. So you know he's somebody who's very good at attacking the back post as well as being somebody who can take a man on. And then he's only started I think 16 league games, something like that. But you know, incredibly warm reception when he came on. Took his goal incredibly well, that turn, the sort of improvised finish the outside of his foot. Yeah, his reaction, he sort of just got a sense of exhaustion. The tears, all the players around him, Villa fans applauding. I even think I saw, and I haven't found a replay of this, but I think I saw a couple of Villa players applauding him as he jogged back. So yeah, enormous warmth towards him. Sort of, you know, the practicalities of it, you don't think about that. David Moyes was talking about it afterwards, that when the invasion happened, Moyes seems to have just said to him, "Look, take as much time off as you want." He said he was, for 3 or 4 days, he's on the phone trying to sort things out. So I don't know the details, but Moyes said he has family here, but also family still in Ukraine. And he said that Fabianski had been really helpful in terms of trying to get people into Poland. It sounds like he's barely trained for the last 2 or 3 weeks. He actually did change the game because it had been a really flat, drab game. He came on, I think, 52 minutes for Mikel Antonio. Mikel Antonio looks absolutely physically exhausted at the minute, barely involved. It was a really kind of... You know, the game seemed to be going nowhere. And then once Yarmolenko had come on, West Ham had a couple of chances, got the goal. Villa then were forced to come out. They got the second goal on the counter. So he did change the game. And with Jared Bowen being out as well, you suspect that if he's in any state to play regularly, he will be playing regularly the next few weeks.
Yeah, West Ham up to sixth with that. But disappointing, I think, for Aston Villa, Robin.
Yeah, I mean, they are firmly mid-table. They went on a pretty poor run recently. And, you know, they're fun to watch, aren't they? Philippe Coutinho is, you know, he's been a great breath of fresh air for them. So, you know, it'll be interesting. I think it's more interesting to see what Aston Villa do in the summer and how they get on next season. I think Gerrard has shown that he's a pretty astute manager. He talks well. He's feel like he's quite a hard man to impress. You know, he seems quite dour, which could be a good thing. So, disappointing result. But when they had Jack Grealish, you really wanted to watch Aston Villa see what he would do. And now actually they've got their sort of fun factor back again, I feel.
I think that's totally true generally. Yesterday, they were awful. Coutinho, I mean, I think it's a sign of how well West Ham play, that combination of Rice and Suárez. Coutinho barely got a kick, and it was only after they'd gone behind that I was really disappointed with him yesterday, because I'd sort of gone along thinking, oh, I'm quite looking forward to seeing Coutinho, seeing this new Villa. And I was sort of sitting there, basically until Yarmolenko came on, going, oh, Christ, what do I write about here? There's nothing, nothing's happening at all in this game. I mean, yeah, give West Ham credit for closing Coutinho down, but there's a lot of Villa time wasting in that first half.
You should have seen Watford, their time wasting. Oh, it was absolutely chef's kiss. It was amazing.
But at least they were doing it 2-0 up though, right? We weren't doing it kind of at 0-0.
Well, you've set it up nicely for me, because that's what we're talking about next. That's it for part two. Part three, we're talking relegation.
Hello, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland here. I now have my own US politics podcast, which is, helpfully, called Politics Weekly America. So if you want to hear my interviews with politicians like Hillary Clinton, or expert analysis from Guardian journalists, and the latest news from Washington, D.C. and beyond, you should subscribe. To do that, just type Politics Weekly America into Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be there every Friday.
Okay, this is fascinating, isn't it? Because Everton, right in this relegation battle, as we've been saying for quite a long time now, and I know there are many people in denial about it, but you can't be in denial about it having watched the performance yesterday. Richarlison really the only player for Everton properly turning it on. They lost 1-0 to Wolves. Connor Cody with his third goal of the season. Simon says, Frank Lampard's Everton, Jonathan Wilson, go. William says, 30 minutes from Wilson on Lampard, please. I'm requesting, Jonathan Wilson, that you don't go for 30 minutes because we've not got that long left of the pod. But 3-2-1, go.
But I hate this kind of question because it makes it sound like I've got some personal animus against Frank Lampard, which I absolutely do not. I did not think he was the right fit for Chelsea. I did not think he did a particularly good job at Chelsea. I thought there were really fundamental flaws in the way his Chelsea set up. I thought he was a bold appointment for Everton. I was slightly surprised by the seeming unanimity of Everton fans welcoming him. And I think there have been some improved aspects in terms of going forward, but defensively they look really ropey. The performance at Tottenham was appalling. One of the worst Premier League performances I can remember. Maybe slightly unfortunate against Wolves, but still didn't play particularly well. And yeah, they're in big trouble.
Yeah, they really are. 22 points from 26 Premier League matches this season. Their lowest ever tally at this stage of any league campaign. Fourth successive defeat in the league. And now only actually out of the bottom three on goal difference. Only Norwich, Barry, have collected fewer points than Everton since Lampard was appointed. They lost 2-1 to Leeds. But, I mean, what a fantastic win for Jesse Marsh, his first as Leeds coach.
Yeah, and he really needed it. I think if Joe Gellhardt hadn't scored that late goal and Timu Pukki hadn't missed that even later chance which came after Gellhardt's goal, Marsh would have been really on the back foot because Leeds fans, I think, didn't particularly want him there in the first place. He lost his first two games, the first of which was a much improved performance from Leeds defensively, but they lost nonetheless. I think fans were already getting sick of him after two games. So he needed that. He needs that breathing space. I must say, I've been impressed with his, you know, the way he handles himself, and he does waffle on about the process being more important than the results. And to an extent, he's right. It's sort of shades of Mikel Arteta, but at the moment, results are everything, and that is a precious 3 points. Norwich are an awful team. I mean, they're one of the worst teams I've ever seen in the Premier League, I think, and it's very difficult to see them extricating themselves from their current pickle after that defeat. They did enough. They could have had a point, you'd have to say they're doomed. But yeah, Leeds have given themselves every chance with that 3 points.
Yeah, they certainly have. They won't have liked the scoreline at Southampton, though, because Watford ended up 2-1 winners there. And you were there for this one, Robin.
Yeah, and it was actually a really good performance from Watford. I think Southampton, well, the first goal in particular was just a massive mistake from Salisu. They were kind of playing it out. They got away with one with Forster, and then Cucho Hernandez, he's becoming a really good goal scorer for them. But as I alluded to before, Ralf Hasenhüttl was so angry after the match because Watford, I mean, it was poetry in motion. Taking it in turns, being injured, you know, going down as soon as Southampton got off a bit of steam. It was textbook time wasting. And, you know, the fans were getting really annoyed. And it is just part of the game. It's not a great spectacle, but Ralf Hasenhüttl, I just felt, and he admitted himself, that maybe the team aren't robust enough to sort of get on with it and deal with it. They're a bit fragile, he said. But referees don't clamp down on it, so you can't let yourself be affected by it. But he was really, really annoyed by the time wasting. But you just got to say that Watford managed the game.
Yeah, I loved your interview actually with Roy Hodgson afterwards. I mean, we should really talk about the handball penalty that Southampton should have had, because it was quite crucial. And you spoke to Roy about it, Robin, afterwards. And the handball law, I mean, I'm not going to wind up Jonathan Wilson again, because he was very succinct in his appraisal of Everton. But the handball law is a bit ridiculous.
Yes, that's right. He sort of said, gather round, children. This is what it used to be like when I was first starting out, that you had to basically catch the ball for it to be handball. And now it's like this. I mean, I think if the referee had given it in real time, it wouldn't have been overturned. His hand was kind of up, Cabaselli, but he was kind of facing the wrong way. So sort of probably by the letter of the law, it should have been a penalty and a handball, but morally it didn't feel quite right. So yeah, a tricky one. But yeah, that decision could be massive in terms of Watford's battle against relegation.
Yeah, absolutely. They'd only won once in 16 league games before this and once in eight since Roy Hodgson was appointed in late January. Possibly the turning point for Watford. Burnley, it feels, have no turning point at the moment. They looked like they were in the ascendancy for sure, but a 2-0 win for Brentford at home to Burnley, late as well. Two goals from Ivan Toney, which means it's back-to-back wins for Brentford over both Norwich and then Burnley. It feels as if Brentford are safe and it feels as if Burnley are really teetering on the edge, Wilson.
Yeah, I was at the Brentford-Newcastle game and they actually set, I mean, you know, the game was over because they were 2-0 down and they had a man sent off. But once Eriksen and Toney had come on, they played pretty well. And I sort of thought, yeah, you never quite know, because Newcastle were clearly sort of sitting back and sort of, yeah, everybody knew they were going to win 2-0. Nothing was going to change. So I was sort of a little bit uneasy about sort of drawing too much from that. But Brentford was so much better once Toney came on, and Eriksen as well. And obviously that story was all about Eriksen making his comeback. But Toney made a huge difference. And suddenly they can score goals again, which has been the big problem for them. So they're up to, what, 30 points now? You would assume 5-6 more points and they'll be safe. And they probably will get them. Burnley, because they had that nice little midwinter break that they gave themselves with injuries and COVID and whatever. They started really well when they came back from that, but they've had a couple of poor results. But I guess we're sort of watching this through an Everton prism, because that obviously they went down, that'd be the biggest story. But Burnley have only played one more game than them and are a point behind. And that's what would worry me if I was an Everton fan, that Leeds look like they're improving, Brentford look like they've done enough, Newcastle certainly look like they've done enough. So it's probably 3 from 5, but Leeds have that 4-point start, admittedly having played 3 games more than Everton. Burnley and Watford suddenly look like they can catch Everton. Again, Everton played 3 games fewer than Watford. Burnley, they need to get back to that form they had sort of 3 or 4 weeks ago. But home to Brentford, I think, is a game where 2 weeks ago you just sort of been saying, yeah, they should win that. But Brentford have improved. But you just hope from a Burnley point of view that isn't sort of one of those defeats that makes them sort of go, like, that's it, it's done.
Yeah. Who goes down for you, Baz?
I think it will be Norwich, Watford, and Everton.
Wow. Robin, you're nodding?
I honestly think Everton could go down because they just look so low on confidence. I know they've got 3 games in hand on Watford, but, you know, you were saying Richarlison was lively, but he doesn't score enough, does he? He gets in good positions. He gets close, but not close enough. And, yeah, I feel Frank Lampard was an odd appointment for the situation that Everton find themselves in. And I don't know, I just can't picture Burnley being relegated, you know? They always seem to wriggle out of it. I just can't see it, but
luck's got to run out at some point, hasn't it?
Yeah.
They've got a relatively gentle run-in. I mean, Everton have still got to play Liverpool and Arsenal. We've got Newcastle on Thursday, which is obviously big. But they've got Liverpool and United and Arsenal and Chelsea, I think, still to come, whereas Burnley got City and Tottenham, but I mean, obviously they've already beaten Tottenham once this season. So I think it's almost a case of those 3 games in hand balance out against the difficulty of the fixtures.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting end to the season, that's for sure. An interesting game yesterday in the Championship. We're calling this Luton Corner. Thank you, producer Joel. Very frustrating from a Luton point of view yesterday. A 2-1 defeat to QPR, meaning QPR leapfrog us into fourth place. We were there for a little while. Really frustrating. Luton down in seventh now. But actually, the officiating in the Championship is what is the most frustrating because it's absolutely shocking. And by the way, I also include our opening goal in that as well, because there was a handball leading into Cameron Jerome's goal. So before any QPR fans get on my back, I mean it. Really, perhaps the game should have been 0-0. Equally, I'd have liked to see whether Adebayo was onside for the goal that was disallowed for us as well. But anybody who doesn't care about either Luton or QPR won't care about my rant, so I'll end it there. More importantly, and finally, how's your Wasp, Barry?
It was at a very low ebb, so I gave it some... This is a Wasp I found on its what appeared to be its last legs in my kitchen. So I did that little thing, made a sugar syrupy drink for it. It fell into the drink. I thought I drowned it. But yeah, after a couple of minutes, it was buzzing around the kitchen light bulb. So I feel like I've contributed something positive at a very negative time.
Well done, you.
What do wasps do that's positive? Don't they just kill aphids?
Well, are you saying they should be sanctioned?
Just to be clear, I'm not advocating genocide. Just to be absolutely clear about that, wasps seem to me one of the less useful creatures.
But it was a living creature, and I was happy to help.
And I suppose it's like the scorpion riding the turtle, isn't it? It's just its instinct. In the same way, you're a vet, you see a stricken animal, you can't help but try to drown it in sugar water.
I'm very much not a vet, I care about... Of course, if it was a mouse, I'd have killed it.
Oh, God. Oh, well, I'm very glad the wasp didn't sting you after you revived it. Well done, Barry. Right, we'll be back on Wednesday. Thank you, Jonathan Wilson. Thank you, Robin Cowan. Thank you, Barry Glendenning. Thank you all as well. And welcome to the world, Ian Rushton. Our producer is Joel Grove and our executive producer is Danielle Stevens. We'll be back on Wednesday.
This is The Guardian.